Welcome to the number one podcast covering Michigan State basketball. The Final Four is not in the schedule. Join Rod and me, Eric, as we dive deep into the Spartans to get you prepared for every game. Subscribe today for in-depth recruiting updates and fantastic interviews with today's important college basketball personalities like Robbie Hummel.
Thanks for having me. I have listened to your guys' podcast numerous times on drives throughout any Midwestern Big Ten city, so I am big fans of your guys' work.
Jay Billis.
And next time, hey, if anybody in Michigan wants a December tea time, call me. You wimps won't show up, but I'll be there. I'll be there and play in the cold. And Izzo will be in front of the fire with hot chocolate.
Coaches Thomas Kelly.
No problem. Glad to be back, man. Glad to be back.
Mike Garland.
Just can't sit there and trade twos for threes. You can't do it. You're going to lose. Coming down the stretch, you're going to lose.
And more. You won't find better coverage of Spartan hoops than you will get here. For both the casual and hardcore fan, come along as we take you for a green and white ride. Hey everybody, it's Eric alongside Rod here to talk about MSU's Big Ten Tournament quarterfinal loss to the Purdue Boilermakers, 67-62. I'd first like to assure everyone that my family and I had a very uneventful trip back from on the light rail after Friday's games without any observed drug use. And unlike the game in West Lafayette, MSU and Purdue didn't shoot the lights out from behind the arc. Michigan State spent the majority of the game playing from behind, only managed to tie the game for just a moment late in the second half, but lost it right away with a three-pointer from Fletcher Lawyer in the corner. Despite the poor shooting, Michigan State did a lot of things well in the game, including their defense generally, making things difficult for Braden Smith and Purdue's guards. They also rebounded extremely well again, staying even on the glass. The Spartans turned the ball over quite a bit with 13 turnovers to Purdue's 11, but a lot of them were, quite frankly, ridiculous offensive foul calls. I don't tend to be someone to complain about how games are officiated too often, outside of how sometimes the refs make the game unwatchable, usually for both teams. But this game, you know, I was blown away by the calls and the way it was called. Maybe it was because I was with a bunch of Michigan State fans behind the basket. I don't know, but I don't think I've ever seen so many charging calls in a season or missed traveling calls.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's Edie, which is a totally entirely different matter.
That's right.
Ultimately, as we mentioned before the game, it sort of felt like house money game for Michigan State. You know, no matter what the outcome, they'd sort of, it'd be a win. If they won, they'd win the game. It could advance. If they lost, they'd probably find themselves on a 10 or maybe at worst case an 11 seed. And so avoiding a potential second round matchup with a one seed in the NCAA tournament. So in that sense, it was an easy game to watch and not worry too much about how it turned out. But it was just incredibly frustrating in sort of how the game unfolded. It came certainly plenty of opportunities, but you know, not unable to make shots that were wide open many times. Now that could be said both ways, I suppose. But I thought Purdue had a lot more challenging shots they're missing, except at the line where, you know, they shot. Edie didn't shoot much different than what he does for the season. So the chances were there, but they just weren't able to seize it.
Well, and I think that's it. We, you know, and I got the chance to vent on this yesterday. On the Spartan Mag board and also on Jack Ebling's show late yesterday afternoon. And we posted that appearance on our Twitter page if you want to hear it, where it was a little fresher in my mind. But because I'm on radio, I'm a little more dialed down than I am here. So it's been, you know, closing in on 24 hours now. Probably more like 19 or so. But I still think my thinking has not changed at all on this. So let's start by saying what you just alluded to, that the way the game was officiated did not cost Michigan State the win per se, in that Michigan State had golden opportunities to get a win in this game by virtue of the shots that they had and missed. Mm-hmm. Good shots, quality shots. You know, when I was talking to Jack yesterday, we both agreed, and I'll assume you do as well, Purdue did not defend Michigan State the way Minnesota did in the opener. They were not as good. You know, Minnesota, say what you want about that team. They came out with a specific game plan oriented to limit what Michigan State could get from three, and they executed it. MSU only got 8 attempts. Now you could say, well, you know, big deal, Purdue gave up 18 three attempts to Michigan State. They only hit four. Yeah, but giving up 18 three attempts to Michigan State, and they were almost all, I'll say maybe one or two were not good looks. Almost all of those were good looks. You don't want to do that if you're Purdue against Michigan State. That's not part of your game plan.
Right.
Because if Michigan State is capable of hitting those, and when they do, if they did, they win this game going away.
Mm-hmm.
If they were on, you know, that was not by design. Believe me, it was not by design. So it's when we talk about the officiating, I want to emphasize that I'm not talking about, even though you could very easily make the case that it cost Michigan State this game, I'm willing to accept that the number one issue for MSU in terms of the loss was the way they missed open shots. That's totally fair. But we got to talk about the officiating. And the reason we have to talk about the officiating is that this is a consistent, chronic problem with officials not being able to call games accurately with this team. And that has an impact on the product. It has an impact on the integrity of the game. And I don't mean that, you know, they want Purdue to win per se. I'm not making that argument, but when you have one team consistently get called the way that they get called, it leads people to correctly wonder what's going on here. Why are we seeing this? And then, you know, the cherry on top is this is a big part of the reason, in my opinion, why Purdue struggles in the NCAA tournament and why I expect them to struggle starting next week. Because they don't get these whistles in the NCAA tournament. Their games are not officiated this way, and there's a reason why they have continued to lose in those situations, and I believe this is part of it. It's also, as we've talked about many times here, but it's related, I guess. It's Purdue can play one way. They have no versatility to them in terms of how they play the game. And when conditions are different, when they're playing a team that plays them differently than they're used to, or they're getting a different whistle, they have problems. They can't adjust. And I think this is, so it's not doing them any favors, in my opinion, either. What was egregious about this one, and you mentioned it, normally we're talking about the way Zach Edey is officiated. And that was a problem in this game, too, as it always is.
Yeah.
You know? The excuse that you hear is, well, he's impossible to officiate because he's 7'9", 800 pounds, and, you know, you can't really officiate a guy that size. Is it a hard job? Yeah, I'll buy that it's difficult, but that's why these guys are getting paid. Where's the standard? Just because it's hard doesn't mean you can't be expected to do a good job. They don't do a good job. They don't. I mean, some of those calls were just, there was one late in the game on Malik call. And again, you didn't have the benefit of replay in the same way that we did. I'm sure they're showing them on the screen. But, oh my God. It was, Edey puts an elbow into Malik in his head or his neck. Malik gets the call. It was incredible. And that stuff happens. Some of the fouls called on Mati Sissoko, who, by the way, played his best game of the year.
Yep.
And was the guy best able to deal with Edey just on a strength basis and worked his ass off. Some of the calls on Mati were a flat joke. A joke. You have to call this guy the same way you call everybody else. And I do not buy the excuse. You know, they used to say this stuff about Shaquille O'Neal. But Shaquille O'Neal was officiated far better than Zach Edey is. No question in my mind. It was never this bad on a consistent level. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to be very... Purdue should consider themselves fortunate beyond belief if starting next week they're getting anything close to the same kind of whistle. And I have a feeling they won't, because they typically don't when they're playing games with officials on a regular basis. There are going to be some quote-unquote strange calls that are going to make things different. So, but that's the consistent problem with Purdue. Yesterday, the part that drove me out of my mind, and I have a feeling this is true for most Michigan State fans, is that Lance Jones baited those that clown car full of officials into five, I counted them, five awful, objectively incorrect calls. Not borderline, bad, missed calls. And most of them were charges. Mm-hmm. Of course, and again, I'm not sure what you saw in the arena or not. The last one was the worst, simply because it was so beyond debate, where he drew a charge against Tyson Walker, what would have been an and one. His foot was halfway in the cylinder.
Yeah, that was
one
yeah,
of his feet was halfway in the cylinder, and they missed it. You can't do that. I'm sorry. You could say, well, it's a hard game to officiate. Again, bullshit. That halfway, this wasn't borderline. This is akin to a 3-point shot being given when half a guy's foot is over the line. It's exactly the same principle. Yeah. Exactly. Now, just for any listeners who don't realize this, that happened with, I think, maybe just a tick over 3 minutes to play. And you might be wondering why they didn't go to review it to the sideline. By rule, they can't review that specific call unless you're under 2 minutes. My thinking is there's no justification for that rule. That is a call. It's exactly, we're talking exactly the same principle as a 3-point shot. And they can go over and review a 3-point shot at any stage in the game. And they do, as we know, we see it with some frequency. Should be the same principle for that call. We aren't seeing it very much because, as you noted, since the rule emphasis change, the charge has been not completely taken out of the game, but it's reduced by what? 80%? Yeah. In terms of frequency of call, I don't know what I haven't run numbers, and I'm not going to, but anecdotally, it's been a huge reduction in the amount of charge calls, which is a great thing for the sport. But all of a sudden, we have Michael Jordan out there in gold and black getting five charges. It was incredible. The one at the end of that first half.
Oh, my gosh.
Malik Hall. And again, what those of us watching on TV were treated to was Stephen Bardo, and I can't even recall who's doing the play-by-play, agreeing with the call. Like, you guys, and I understand Big Ten Network is never going to get out on a limb and say, boy, these officials are really hacking it up. That's not their MO. You're never going to see that. But, my God. You can't say, you should just be silent when that plays. Maybe you say, aha, that's something, and leave it at that. You don't want to criticize it? Okay. Don't try to, as the saying goes, don't piss on our heads and tell us it's raining. I mean, it was something else. So that was the part that really drove me crazy, is that Lance Jones gets the benefit of five bad calls. Not Michael Jordan, not LeBron James, not even Zach Edey. Lance Jones. Are you kidding me? The last one, that cylinder call, and I said this on Jack's show, I'll repeat it here because my mind hasn't changed. That one call, in my mind, given the ease of the call and the context, the situation, that one call is bad enough that those guys should not work again the rest of this year. They shouldn't work another Big Ten tournament game. They shouldn't work any NCAA tournament games. And they should be forced to sit in a room for several days and watch those calls on loop until they get it in an attempt to save them. That's what should happen. I know better. I know what's going to happen. I expect those guys to be working because that was a high-profile crew, and it's shameful. And in my mind, the Big Ten really, really needs to get a handle on this. They got to look at themselves in the mirror because, and we've talked about this before with regard to Purdue, but this is as a product, and I'm trying to be as objective as I can be. It's honest to God. This is not about Michigan State losing a game. This is about the brand of basketball that this Purdue team plays, what it looks, how it actually is aesthetically. It is ugly.
Yeah.
It is ugly. It is clunky. It's awful. Nobody wants what you said to me. You texted me during the game. You said nobody in this arena outside of Purdue fans wants them to win. And that's not unusual for a team that's a heavy favorite, right? But I really do. I firmly believe this is a little different. This is beyond just that stuff. We don't like to watch this. This isn't entertaining. It's kind of gross.
Yeah. Well, and you know, along those lines, I have two thoughts too with what you're talking about. But we were at the last game last night was Nebraska versus Indiana, and I would say, aside from Purdue fans who might have been sticking around, which is probably not a whole lot, they're obviously going to be cheering against Indiana. Nebraska was a favorite, and that arena was treated to Tominaga at the end of the first half. For those who watched, it was not only fun to watch him play and hitting the shots and, you know, they went on the, I don't know, whatever it was to nothing run to finish the half and, you know, eliminate Indiana. But the way they play with just sheer joy, it is infectious. And it was everything that the Purdue team isn't. Like everything that Zach Edey is, he just looks angry. It's sort of like for the same reason people enjoy watching Caitlin Clark. Yes, she hits the shots and all those things, but I think just the way they play and it's open and they seem to have having fun, like playing a game, it seems less a chore. And I think that's why, that's just the contrast and sort of the product you want when you talk about what's unwatchable. You know, not that anyone particularly cares about Nebraska, I don't think. I mean, maybe it's cute because it's Nebraska, and that's why some people may pull for them a little bit over Indiana. But ultimately, it's because just the way they play and just how they, it's just the joy they have is what draws you to cheer for them. So back to your statement about the officiating.
I want to comment to what you just said. This is just my opinion. What I want to be careful of with that kind of comparison, I agree with everything you said, but I am not anti-post player.
Right. No, I understand.
I love watching Jackson Kohler try to go to work against people in the post. Now, he's not converting as much as I would like, but that footwork, to me, that's joyful to watch. That's fun. That's aesthetically pleasing to watch. Watching a big man, when I used to watch Derek Nix pass out of double teams and find a shooter, that was aesthetically pleasing basketball. It's not about, well, post plays boring and I don't want to watch that. Because there are people that think that way. There are people that, you know, positionless basketball and post play is dead. I'm not one of those at all. Mm-hmm. But Zach Edey is, you're right, it's soulless. It's gross. It's not aesthetically pleasing. It's very, very effective. I don't question that. But it's not something I want to watch. It's not entertaining. And you're right. He also plays with zero joy. And I'm sure he's a nice guy. I don't think this is a character flaw. I just think it's honestly, objectively, it's not something I ever want to watch. And I don't say that. The only other guy in recent memory in the Big Ten that I felt similarly about was the Mello Trimble show when he was at Maryland, because the kid's entire game was predicated on throwing himself to the hoop like a fullback and either managing to hit a layup or drawing a foul. And it was similarly just tedious to watch. Totally different context in terms of why Edie is that way, but it's the same end result for me. I don't want to watch it. And that's not true of other post players. It doesn't, for me at least, it doesn't take a Tominaga hurling up circus shots from 30 feet to be entertaining. There's lots of ways that basketball can be beautiful. Zach Edey just isn't hitting on any of them.
Yeah, Zach.
Anyway,
No, that's fine. And he sort of, it just came to mind, it sort of reminds me of like getting the cheat code in a video game. And that you just sort of found a way to just score without actually actually having to have any skill at the game. You just sort of you're like a giant.
Yep.
So back to the one thing is that, you know, I understand the complaint about the reviewability of plays like that. And personally, I think, you know, I understand why people want things reviewed. Maybe there's some way you could have the coaches get a challenge or something like that. The less breaks we have in the game, the better. And so that's just watching standpoint and being a fan of the stands, because partly the problem, especially when you're in the stands, you never really know what's going on. No one ever tells you. You're on TV, you have some idea,
right?
You know, oh, they're looking at someone getting hit, clunked in the head or something. You have no clue when you're in the stands, and they never announce it, so it's annoying. But
I hear you on that, but my only point, and I'm not advocating for let's review every borderline call. I'm with you. You can't do that. That call in particular, though, because we do it for 3-point shots, and it's normally pretty clear cut. Guy's foot is on the line or it's not. If we're going to do it for 3-point shots, we ought to do it for those plays. And let's also be honest, that particular call does not tend to come up very often.
No. They usually get that right.
So
it's because it's so easy to see.
Right. So let's review it. I mean, as you say, maybe the solution is, because Michigan State, of course, knew that it was at their end of the floor. They knew it was a bad call.
And all our fans are right there, too.
Right. Everybody knew.
Yeah.
So that's a circumstance where, in my mind, you got to look at this 2-minute rule. Get rid of that. Because it's something that, the other thing, too, is you have to think about, well, what would go into a review in terms of efficiency? Those are calls that should be pretty quick.
Yeah.
Pretty easy to make. So that's why I'm in favor of, in general, I hear you. We already have a lot of reviews that slow the game down. Do we really want to add more? But that was an example of a critical missed call that just had no business being missed. None.
And the second one is, I guess question is about the officiating when it comes to the big regular season versus the postseason in the NCAA tournament.
Uh-huh.
I understand they're regular crews, and now they're not hired by the Big Ten. They're hired by the teams, I believe, and so they are free agents, and so you sort of get whoever's available. My son officiates soccer, and so it's sort of like that. Like they just go into pool, they find people, and they just end up, you know, officiating games, and so it's not like a specific even crew that's always working together. I mean, they're three guys who just happen to have their schedule available.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe in the Big Ten tournament, they're different. I haven't paid enough attention to know that it's always the same three guys. I know they don't do all four games or more than one game in a day. But anyway, that's sort of beside the point. The question I have is, you know, preseason, you know, the non-conference before the regular season starts, then there's a regular season, and then there's the NCAA tournament. Why is it so different in the NCAA tournament versus the preseason and then the Big Ten season? Because I would think, I know the NCAA tournament, I see the same guys, they're there. Now they're not working together, so you'll see DJ Carsonson, but he'll just be there with, like, you know, maybe a guy from Missouri Valley who does Missouri Valley games generally, or whatever, a guy who does Pac-12 games. I'm not sure how that works. Why is it so different? Like, I just, that's the thing I don't understand, because it seems to me that they're calling the same things in the preseason, but then yet when it comes to NCAA tournament, the games are just called differently. And I just don't understand why that is. I mean, or is it my perception, or is that real?
No, I think it's real. I think in general, you've seen enough Michigan State basketball in the NCAA tournament in the last quarter century to be able, your feel, your eyes are not lying to you. The games tend to be called differently, and that doesn't mean that every game is called differently than a Big Ten game tends to be. but it means a lot more of them are. And so in my view, what that has typically meant is you do not have as quick a whistle, more physical play tends to be allowed. Michigan State over the years has generally been, and we're talking generally, a physical team that has usually gotten called for more fouls than opponents. I think in Big Ten games, I mean, I think that's generally been true.
Okay.
And then that, you know, we talk all the time about how, oh, it kind of feels like the shackles are off when they get into the tournament, right? Well, that's mm-hmm. part of it, that the games tend to be more free-flowing because you're not having a whistle every 5 seconds, you know? Now, when you talk about the nature of, and this is a complicated subject, we're not going to solve this today, but it is true. There is no such thing, and a lot of fans misunderstand this because they see the same guys every week, and they assume, well, that guy's, you know, DJ Carstensen is a Big Ten official. He's not. He is a independent contractor who is certified by the NCAA. He works Division I games, and you're right. The schools hire them, but you see the same guys working Big Ten. It doesn't mean those are the only games that he works, which gets to another big beef I have with this, with how the system works. But they are the same guys. The conference schools kind of land on their list of guys that they'll utilize. And I think that it's true that a style for that reason tends to exist. It's not fantasy. It's real. And in the NCAA tournament, you are talking about a broader pool of people. So, and you have to have noticed this over the years. When you see a Michigan State game in the tournament, you're usually seeing at least some guys you've never seen before.
Oh, yeah.
Officiating those games. Well, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about guys that aren't typically being utilized for Big Ten games. And it does make it, it does lead to different results. And I was going to get back to what my real beef is with this system. And what's got, to me, it's the starting point of what's got to change. What's got to change is this independent contractor thing where these guys are free to take as many games as they can get. If you look at some of these officials, you will see, and there was a website a few years ago, I haven't checked in recently to see if it still exists, that was a tracker of yeah. every official and every game they were working. Some of these guys are working 6 nights a week
mm-hmm.
or days. 6 days a week. That should not happen. I don't believe NBA officials do that many games in a week. I don't think. And look at the system we've set up. They get paid, again, and they're independent contractors, so they're free to take. Nobody's there governing them. They can take as many games as they can get. And if you're an official, you want to make some money, like, well, why shouldn't I take as many as I can get? And some of these guys do. Literally, they're working 6 nights a week. That might not sound crazy to people. Well, it's only 2 hours. No. You're flying. You watch where these guys are officiating games. They're zigzagging the country. So they're on flights all the time, mm-hmm. checking in. I mean, you're dealing with in and out of hotels. If you don't live that life, and I've gotten glimpses, more than glimpses at times in my life of what that feels like, but for shorter periods, where you're out for, say, a month and a half and you're in a different city every day, just that process takes a toll on you. And when you're performing a physically oriented task like they are, it's grueling. And you cannot convince me that that does not have an impact on the quality of the work that's being done. So the first thing I would do to start addressing this, because college basketball has an officiating problem. It's probably the only thing you could get virtually every fan of the sport in America to agree on, is that college basketball has an officiating problem. So how do we start solving it? To me, maybe the approach you've got to take is, you know what? We need to actually go to conferences having their own officials, therefore having control on how much they're working, and maybe you start paying them more for that purpose, to lock them in, to have them working less frequently, but they're not taking a financial hit, or at least not much from one. Maybe that's part of the process. I don't know. But this thing is not working. This is a joke. It is a joke when you see a guy flying zigzag in the country for six games a week and you think that he's going to be good. Come on. That just defies logic. It just does. It's think that that's a viable system to get you the best possible product. And in a sport like basketball, which by its very nature, I think, is of the major sports in America, the four major sports, I think it is by far the hardest to officiate because of the size of the athletes, the size of the court, and the speed of the game, and just the nature of the rules themselves. I think basketball has more judgment calls than any other sport. It's the hardest. So you're already talking about something that's at a more difficult level than other sports to properly, properly evaluate. And then you add in all these other events, these factors rather. Come on, we got to get serious about this. So to me, that's what's got to happen. Or it's a starting point.
Well, sure. Yeah. Well, let's go talk about the game a little bit. And we'll just get into our segments and start with the brothers Jesse Gutters, the player that Michigan State needs to keep in the gutter. It is spring, so it is rainy season. It's time to make sure that the water that comes and approaches your house stays away from your house. And so that only can be accomplished with really good gutters. The brothers Jesse Gutters just do gutters. That's all they do. They specialize in it. They do fantastic work, great pricing, super competent, very friendly people. They did our house and took care of everything. They helped my wife's office so they can do commercial projects. Basically anything job, either small or large, they can take care of it. Maybe it's just a downspout. Maybe you just need to get your leaves out of your gutter, whatever it might be, cleaning it out, repairing it, replacing whatever, they can do it. 10% off. You mentioned Final Four. When you get your estimate, you can get that on the east side of the state with Kurt and his team, or the west side, the Greg and his team, and the west side of the state with Kurt and his team. They will take care of that. Go to the Final Four is on theschedule.com/support. There you can find links to get an estimate from either gentleman to take care of your gutters. And so the player that Michigan State was supposed to keep in the gutter was Braden Smith, who actually I thought Michigan State did a very good job in neutralizing, not him, but just playing the guards and making their life difficult. He had played 26 minutes now. He left partway through the first half, I think, with a ankle or calf injury.
Eventually, they called it a calf injury. It looked like a knee injury, and it looked really bad. But obviously, he came back. If you look at the numbers, 5 points, 2 of 7 from the floor. He hit his only three-pointer. They didn't put him on the line. 8 assists, but 5 turnovers.
Yeah, that was the 5 turnovers.
And Michigan State did a good job on him. And I'll tell you what, especially in the second half, the injury probably had something to do. It was in the second half, actually, I think. The injury had something to do with continuing to limit him. But even before that,
he wasn't getting
loose. No. And I'm telling you, saying it all year, and I know people, best point guard in the Big Ten. I wanna see it. Michigan State didn't do everything that I think is best to give yourself a good chance to beat Purdue. They didn't apply heavy ball pressure per se, but Michigan State guarded the shit out of him. And 5 turnovers, man. He has a night like this in the NCAA tournament, they're in trouble. Opponent. Yeah, right, yeah. Exactly. That's what I mean. That he is the head of the snake. And if you contain him, Zach Edey, 29 points. They didn't stop Zach Edey, but they contained Braden Smith. And, boy, lo and behold, Michigan State's in it with a legitimate chance to win. I think we identified the right guy.
I don't think there's any question. And there's no question defensively. And my guess is that the defensive strategy was similar to what it was in West Lafayette. You know, dig down on Edie, go back out into the shooters, but they just were better executing, I think, this game. Preventing the Purdue from this wide open threes like they were in West Lafayette.
They also did a better job, in my opinion, of keeping him. I thought in West Lafayette, he was able, generally speaking, to get to the spots on the floor he wanted to get to.
Yes.
Meaning he'd get into the lane, he could get himself into gaps where there were open shots available, and that did not happen yesterday.
Yeah, he was just harassed more, and so that was and he doesn't look as comfortable with when there's really, you know, tight pressure on him. There's some guys you see and they're okay with guys, and he's not one of them.
You saw mm-hmm. it in person. I think you could see what I've been talking about. He's just people can argue about this if they want, but I think it's very evident that he is a different. Some guys are fine. You know, you could put that 94-foot pressure against Mateen Cleaves or Cassius Winston, and they might have a possession or two where it gets to them. But by and large, you never felt like, wow, they're really wilting under this. This is taking something out of them. There are other guys who are great when they're allowed to play freely. But when you apply that kind of pressure, you put them under that kind of heat, they struggle. They start to wilt. I am still convinced that is the type that Braden Smith is. He's got to prove it otherwise. And I'm just praying that we see a matchup that he has to withstand that in the next week or so, because I don't want this team to win. I mean, flat out, I'll say it. Normally, I'm fine with non-Michigan Big Ten teams succeeding in the tournament, not this group. I think they're bad for basketball, and I don't like the way they play. And also, I'll admit there's some self-interest in it. I'm working on a two-year theory about these guards, and I'd like to be proven right again. So we'll see what happens. But I think they kept him in the gutter.
Yes, no question. And that was even, like you said, the injury was sort of didn't matter too much as far as that went. He was just as shaky afterwards as he was before and unable to sort of get what he wanted. So then moving along to the Squeegee Squad of Grand Rapids, sponsor the player in Michigan State that cleans the glass the best. We talk about rain, leaves splotches on your windows, makes the side of your house dirty or your business. The Squeegee Squad of Grand Rapids, if you're in the Grand Rapids area, will take care of all that. They, you know, might make it hazardous for birds as they smash into your windows, but outside of that, they do great stuff for you. Make sure you contact them. You get 15% off. You mentioned Rebound when you get your estimate. Again, that's at the support page at tffinots.com/support. They will come out, take everything, be meticulous. They'll not only get the inside, but the outside, the windowsills. They'll also power wash your house if you need it or your business. Again, they can work on any job. No job is too big or too small for the Squeegee Squad. They'll come out and take care and clean your glass. And just when I said, well, there's no chance of Mati Sissoko doing anything, he's hardly playing, I was once again proven wrong. And he tied Malik Hall for 7. So I think you had Malik. So you get a half point. So you're up, what, 7 to 6.5, I think, now?
Yep, that's right.
Hopefully not the last game, but possible. So you got a narrow edge here. Mati played only 10 minutes and had 7 rebounds, 4 of them offensive. He was a complete monster on the boards, which is what he has been, you know, earlier in the season. So good for him. I mean, it was great to see him, as you mentioned, his best performance of the year. And he just gets, because he's unwilling to move on the block, is why he gets all those fouls and fouled out in this game by Zaki, because Zaki just discards him. But it is crazy how much he just, since he's unwilling to move, that he gets called for fouls for just Zaki just backing him down and pushing him down. The hook and hold at the end, I don't understand that call. I don't know. They didn't call hook and hold, but their arms are locked, and I don't know whose fault it is when it happens. I'll give you that one. But the ones where he just like just pushes you back and is while he's also traveling, we're not even going to talk about that. Just irritating.
Tom Izzo was, if you watched him on the sideline, he was trying to work that call all game long. You could see him by virtue of, even if you can't read lips, you could see by virtue of his body language when he was talking to officials, he was constantly talking about Edie backing people down and why that's not being, trying to get a call on that. You're absolutely right. But let's put that aside. We leaned on the officiating enough. Mati Sissoko was energized. He was physical. He was relentless. That's the Mati Sissoko that I think we'd hoped to see at the start of this season on a regular basis, and we really haven't. It was great. They had no choice but to play him in this game because of, again, the Edie effect and the foul trouble that everybody was in. That's why he played 10 minutes. It's the only reason he played 10 minutes. But, boy, that was a productive, productive 10 minutes of play. And just the way he just chased down, rebound, as you said, 4 offensive rebounds in 10 minutes, 7 total. That's crazy. That's a crazy rebounding rate. And if he'd been able to play 20, I think he would have doubled that.
Yes.
The rate he was going, I think that was an honest representation of the impact that he was going to have. Every minute he was going to be on the floor in that game, he was going to produce, at least in that area of the game. So just good for him. He gave Michigan State, he was another reason that Michigan State had a chance because mm-hmm. of the way he battled Edie. So hats off to him. Thank God he didn't play more minutes in the end and in only one totally not important sense because it allowed Malik to tie for the rebounding lead, which has given me the ever so slight edge in our competition. But I got to look for a silver lining in this thing somewhere, right?
Yeah,
so that's the one I'm taking.
And I think the great thing about Mati right now is he is not, you know, whether Mati plays or not, a lot of minutes is not really critical to the success of the team in some respects. And so he might as well play with reckless abandon and use up your 5 fouls. Who cares if you foul out? It's not, you know, tactically a big deal in the game for the team.
That's a good point. And that might have been part of the reason why we saw what we saw. Now, it's also easy to get into that mindset against Edie because you know going in, you're just because of the way that they choose to deal with him, that you're going to get called for fouls. So there's no point worrying about it. And maybe that is, though, reflective as well of a mindset difference that Mati is, because he's not playing much anymore, that he's able to look at it and say, hey, every minute you got on the floor is a gift. So don't worry about anything. Just go get it. If you get called for fouls, you get called for fouls.
Yeah, and I think there's no question when you have a guy playing like that, like we saw briefly with Carr earlier this season, you know, and he's looked that like that more recently. The whole team just responds differently.
Absolutely.
They all start going after it more. And that's, you know, infectious. I mean, energy is infectious, just like runs are in college.
I saw people yesterday saying online to some extent that part of the reaction was positive reaction to the way Michigan played, even in losing, was that for maybe the first time this year, or one of the rare times at least, it actually looked recognizable. It's like, oh, that's right. That's Michigan State basketball. And that's mm-hmm. true. They played that way. I mean, we can all cite lots of moments. Mati had them, but really there were a lot of guys who at different points contributed those kind of moments. I can think about even the young guys. Cohen Carr trying to leap over Zach Edey late in that game.
That was
a turnover. Tom Izzo hugged him. I thought early in the game, Xavier Booker, and he missed the dunk, he got fouled, but trying to make a statement by just cocking the ball back, and it's something really only he can do where he's, you know, almost 5 feet away from the rim and he's still trying to dunk it because he's got that kind of length, but going hard at the rim. Those kind of moments were they're infectious, and they remind people of the principles this program's been built on.
All right, well, let's go through the keys of the game. We can talk a little bit more about the specific game besides officiating. This brought to you by Nudge Printing. If you need comfortable gear, like me yesterday and my son, we're sitting there with our Final Fours on the schedule hoodies, but it's basically just all the stuff they have at Nudge is super comfortable, great Spartan gear. If you need your stuff for your games or tailgates or just around the town, there's no better place to go than Nudge Printing. We've been super happy with it. They provide all the gifts for us for our prizes for our contests. So head on over to Nudge Printing at nudgeprinting.com, 20% off your order. If you type in Final Four, just as one word, into the checkout code. And again, it's just fantastic stuff, super durable. They've been washed millions of times. They still look great and still feel great. So the first key of the game is play fast. And this is the one thing that, you know, unfortunately, AJ ended up with two fouls early in that second half. Well, I mean, not early, but like 10 minutes in or 12 minutes in. So we had to sit a decent amount of that first half because of charge calls. But he played fast. They were flying in that. And it was just a testament to what you've been talking about all season. When they play fast, they can not only get the transition points, but they really make it a little difficult for the defense. And then they just all start moving a lot better. So anyway, it was really good to see that I think he played a really great game overall throughout the entire 40.
He did. I can, as is always the case, I can find a couple of shots that he took that I thought he settled for.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I'm not going to lean on that. Look, kid had 10 assists to 2 turnovers, 5-1 ratio. He did score 8 points. I thought he played well defensively. And you're right. He kept the pace, the energy level offensively up where it needed to be. And my complaints with Michigan State are offensively are only down to one thing. And it's just one of those things that happens. They just didn't hit enough shots. They got good shots. They got more than enough good shots. And that was a result, in my view, of the way they ran offense, the tempo with which they played. Now, you know, transition, 18 fast break points in this game.
Yeah.
Purdue, 0, goose egg. That's not unusual. Purdue's not a running team. But an 18-0 edge in that category, that was a big contributor to why this game was close. And so that's, again, not the be-all and end-all of what we're talking about when we talk about playing with pace. But it was part of it, for sure, that Michigan State was energized. They were looking to play fast. And, you know, this was a game where they didn't get the benefit of what often gets the running game going, which is live ball turnovers. Mm-hmm. That they generate. They only had 4 steals in this game. It was mostly vintage Michigan State transition basketball where they got it simply because the mentality was there. We're going to, at every opportunity, we're going to push. And so, yeah, AJ was a big part of it, but the whole team, I thought, played really well in that regard. They just didn't get enough of those good shots they generated to drop.
Second key to the game was rebounding. And again, Michigan State, I don't know what it is against Purdue. They just decide they're going to rebound, but they actually out-rebounded Purdue 37-36. They had 14 offensive rebounds. Purdue ended with had 12. So I think it's almost like identical offensive rebounding rate of 30-some percent I calculated last night.
Pretty close.
So, I mean, so in some ways you say, well, Michigan State didn't do a great job because Purdue had a decent amount of offensive rebounds. It is so there's not much you can do about that. Second chance points were 12 for Purdue and 7 for Michigan State. So that sense, they didn't help Michigan State as much. But, you know, they weren't pummeled on the boards like you could happen. And then it would, you know.
Well, I can think of one segment where Michigan State got 3 chances at the basket.
All, so, yeah.
2 offensive rebounds, all good looks. They just couldn't get one to drop. Mm-hmm. That might have happened a couple times in that game.
I think there's one they had 3 and they didn't. Yep. They missed 4 times on the same possession.
Yeah. So the second chance points in, okay, Purdue got a little more out of it, granted, but Michigan State had their chances. It wasn't because the rebounding area let them down. They generated the chances. They just didn't get shots to drop. You can't fault the job Michigan State did on the board. So let's also keep in mind, as we've said before, I think when you take both ends into consideration, this is the best rebounding team in America. So, yeah, to give up 12 offensive rebounds, well, you kind of expect that's what Purdue's going to do to you. And at least Michigan State didn't let it get ridiculous. But for MSU to get 14 on their offensive end against a top 20 defensive rebounding team, that's doing work. And we talked about with Mahdi, and he wasn't the only one. He was the most obvious one. But, you know, when I look at it, Malik had two offensive rebounds. Jackson Kohler had two. And then a bunch of guys with one. MSU did the job.
So third key to the game was guarding the arc, and this is a real problem for Michigan State and West Lafayette. Despite Michigan State shooting really well, almost 50%, Purdue actually shot 50% with relatively high volume. This game was not so much. Obviously, the one that was a killer was the one by Fletcher Lawyer at the end, where his only attempt. But yeah. I think it's a testament that Purdue only got up 14. They only hit five, and they were almost all contested. The ones that weren't, they hit. Braden Smith, yep, and Lawyers. So, and Mason Gillis.
Gillis,
I think,
right,
Michigan State did a really good job defending the arc. They just, unfortunately for Michigan State, their wide open ones, they were missing, and Purdue hit their wide open ones.
Yeah, and that was, you know, it was a slight edge for Purdue. They made one more three than MSU did. They shot a little better percentage, but look, we said this going in, the problem with the game in West Lafayette was you didn't stop either end. Zach Edey goes for 32, and you give up 10 for 20 from three. That's a hard way to live if you're going to win. This game, Zach Edey did his work, you know, 29 points, but MSU really did largely shut down the threes. And as you were saying, it's not just about the success rate. It's also about the attempts. Purdue wants to get, and typically will get, more than 14 attempts out. Michigan State didn't let that happen. And to their credit, as you say, the ones that went down tended to be the ones, the rare shots that were truly wide open. And that'll happen. You're not going to perfectly contest every shot in a game. But, you know, and again, another, I'll give Purdue credit, another sign of a winning team is when you hit the shots that you need to hit in big moments. Fletcher Lawyer had one three-point attempt in that game. It was that one that came late when the game was tied, and yep, they came right down and hit it. Gillis hit a big one late. I mean, they got shots when they had to have them. And that's, you know, that's a sign of a good team. And that's why it's so challenging to go in and beat a team like that, because they are capable of making those plays. But I do think Michigan State can feel good about the job it did in that area overall.
Yeah, the only thing I'd say too is that that was a game where Purdue had very little stress, although it was a tight game throughout. It wasn't until, had Michigan State taken the lead, I think, and that arena had turned on them, I think it would have, things might have turned a little bit for Purdue. They don't look this. I think, you know, just going back to Braden Smith, I think that is certainly where they're vulnerable. And I think, you know, if they get into like a NCAA tournament game, like what happened Fairleigh Dickinson, I could see them fold just like before. But, well, we'll see. So fourth key to the game is turnovers. Michigan State actually had more turnovers than Purdue, which is unusual for this Michigan, yeah, State team. But, of course, as you mentioned, five of them were offensive charges. I don't know there's much more to say about that. It's not like Purdue got a whole lot done with the turnovers. Yeah.
The only thing I would say is Purdue's starting guards, the three of them, combined 9 turnovers. The rest of their team only had 2. That's not a good sign. I go back to my theory about what's waiting for them on the other side of this weekend. That's not an equation you want to see if you're a Purdue fan. Smith with 5, Lawyer with 3, Lance Jones only 1. But that's not, you know, 9 assists to 9 turnovers, a 1-to-1 ratio from your 3 starting guards. not good. Not
especially when
good at all.
Charges like Michigan.
Right. They yeah. were, it was just a lot of travel calls. It was just sloppy stuff. And again, it's tournament basketball now. So the pressure is ramped up. And I'm sorry. They could prove me wrong. And I would admit that there's a chance to actually do it. I don't believe in these guys as pressure, just don't.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And the fifth and final key of the game is a sharpness advantage. I think that was,
yeah.
There was no advantage there as both nope. teams came right out and looked sharp hitting shots to start. I mean, didn't persist, but certainly the teams looked like they were comfortable out there. And so there's no advantage there as, you know, Purdue looked
yeah,
like they were lost.
Yeah, then Purdue didn't need, you know, 10 minutes to get their legs underneath them as you kind of hoped would be the case. But at the same time, neither team shot the ball well. I mean, Purdue, 41.5% overall, 35.7% from three, 67% on a boatload of free throw attempts. That's not a great performance at all for that team. MSU, 39% overall, 22% from three, 83% at the line. So at least they were dialed in at the line, but on far fewer attempts. No real edge for Michigan State. If anything, you would say, I think Michigan State in general had maybe a little better shot quality in that game. I felt certainly in terms of jumpers, you can, you know, Edie kind of distorts that a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think Michigan, let's put it this way, Michigan State had totally acceptable shot quality. They just didn't hit enough of them, so you can't say that they were as sharp as they were against a better defensive effort in the first game, in my view.
Right, right. All right, so let's move along to a listener question for the show. If you have a question you'd like answered, send it along as a text or voice memo to me, Eric, at tffinots.com. And today's question is brought to us from the Brothers Just Two Gutters proprietor, Kurt Stauffer, part of the Grand Rapids crew, who asks, is this the worst shooting team in the history of the Spartans? If they improve their shooting 1%, 2%, 3%, et cetera, how many games would they have won? My hunch is a 5% improvement, and they'd be undefeated. They seem to dominate a number of shots, but they have made it hard to watch when they seem to miss everything when the game is on the line. I can't remember watching a worse shooting team. At least that is how they look. They never make the big shots when they count. And so I looked up at least the last 6 years, which is easy to find. So this year, and this is before... this is before the Minnesota game, so it probably has not changed much. So Michigan State is shooting 46, 36, and 70. So that's field goal percentage, three-point percentage, free throw percentage. Last year, 45, 39, 75. The year before, 46, 38, 75. Year before that, 42, 32, 73. Then the COVID cancel year was 46, 35, 75. The year they went to the Final Four, they were 48, 38, 75. And it's interesting, you look at those numbers and there's not a whole lot of difference. You can definitely see the year where they squeaked in with Aaron Henry at 42, 32, and 73. This year, I think you'd say the three-point shooting is down from last year a teensy bit. The free throw shooting is definitely worse at from 75 to 70%. But from a shooting standpoint, there's not a whole lot of difference. And it's interesting, actually, because I mean, I had no idea when I started looking these numbers up if it would there'd be much of a difference, but it is actually remarkable how similar those numbers really are. They really hardly move at all.
Well, it's clearly, I mean, I appreciate the question, Kurt, but this is clearly not the worst shooting team in Tom Izzo. Forget Michigan State history in Tom Izzo's tenure. You pointed out the 21 team that squeaked into the tournament with that late run. In my view, a much worse, substantially worse shooting team. I'm looking right now at another very disappointing team, the 2010-2011 team. They shot 35% from three, 46.7% from two, a little worse than this team was.
Yeah.
You know, no, this is not. Now, what you might be able to say, and it's hard to measure these things with any kind of accuracy, but were they maybe unable to come up with clutch shots less often than some other teams? Maybe. I don't know. As we've talked about before, there haven't been a ton of situations like that this year. This team hasn't played as many close games as it, at least anecdotally, it seems that way to me, as we're used to seeing. They tend to either win comfortably or, you know, lose a game. But yeah, it's not a great shooting team. It's not as good a shooting team as they had a year ago. That much is unquestionably true. But, you know, it's also, as I look at it, it's also a significantly better defensive team. Yes. I mean, they're currently ranked ninth in defensive efficiency. Last year's team was 42nd. I mean, yeah. Michigan State, I'm doing a quick run through here. The last time MSU had a top 10 defensive team was the year they went to the Final Four last in 2019, where they were also ninth. It's been a long time since we've seen a defense at that level. So this team has had different strengths, but I don't think it's been an abysmal shooting team. Yeah. It just isn't as good as maybe we'd hoped for. And I think this is maybe the final point I'll make. I think part of it is that there's maybe been, and again, I'm not trying to quantify this, and I could be wrong objectively, but my anecdotal impression is, especially as the year has worn on, maybe the back half of the Big Ten schedule and yesterday, the last 2 days, it is a very inconsistent shooting team.
Yes.
They tend to be feast or famine. We don't have a lot of games where we're like, oh, you know, they were 6 for 15 from three. They were good. They weren't great. They were just kind of what you expect them to be, solid. Not a lot of that. It's 5 for 8 or 4 for 18. You know, it's one or the other. I wanted to talk a moment, because I imagine many of our listeners are at least interested in the topic, about what our rivals down the road did yesterday.
Okay.
I think we should touch on that.
Let's talk about my topic real quick.
Sure.
Just because it's really related to the Big Ten tournament.
Sure.
You know, I'm here in Minneapolis, actually currently recording in a stairwell. That's how much we love you guys. Just want you to realize that. And I know we talked about the other night real briefly, but that we expect the tournament to be at West. They have not decided on venues. And I also recognize that the main revenue from the Big Ten tournament comes from eyeballs on TVs. And so I don't expect that the fan experience, the live fan experience is as important to the Big Ten, gate sales and those sorts of things. But I would say this, the attendance is not great here in Minneapolis compared to, you know, I've only have 5 years of going to games, but it's not great. And it's because of the location. It's difficult. But I would also say this. Most conference tournaments, from what I can gather, they're always in the same place. Like, the ACC is always in the same place. The Big East is always in Madison Square Gardens. I think, you know, most of the ones out west are in Vegas. Yep. And I think that consistency, the routine is important for these conference tournaments, because there's a certain type of person who goes to these tournaments, and moving it around. And I recognize the Big Ten is, you know, coast to coast now, or certainly next year, and so that's going to make it difficult. But that makes it a lot easier to sort of plan these sorts of things. And if your live in-person experience is worse, and you could definitely feel that on television, you know, then it's going to make the interest in the tournament overall less. And I think it's a risk for the league to continue moving it around. Yeah, it'd be cool if it was in Detroit, so it makes it easier for Michigan State fans. But I think, honestly, just keep it in Indianapolis. We have no problem having the football game in Indianapolis every year. And quite frankly, it makes no sense to move it around, in my opinion. If what we say it's all dependent on eyeballs on television, no one cares if they're watching on television where the game is played, as long as it's a time that's convenient for them to watch it. So they don't care if it's Indianapolis for the Big Ten football, or if it's in, you know, Columbus or wherever. It doesn't matter. That, as long as you have it in the same place every time and make it consistent for fans, I think that is best. And you want a place that is easy for the most people to get to, and that is I think Indianapolis or some sort of place right in the middle of the traditional Big Ten country. And moving it around adds nothing. It doesn't add sachet or anything like that. It just makes it more complicated and difficult for people. And you're not going to attract new fans. I don't think having Las Vegas is suddenly going to have a massive influx of UCLA or Oregon fans to the Big Ten tournament. You're just going to end up cutting out 80% of the people who usually go to it. And so I think it'll be dismally, maybe Vegas, you could squeeze some people in there. But like having LA in the Staples Center would be a huge mistake. I know I'm just talking to our fans, and so it's not going back to the Big Ten. But I think it is a mistake to move it around so much. I think, honestly, just having one place, maybe go back and forth from Chicago, but Chicago's annoying too. I don't know. That's just my take on it. As someone who goes to it live, I'm just, if it's in LA, I'm just not going, and just, or in Seattle or something like that, just because it's just a big pain in the butt. I just don't know.
I think it's going to happen.
Oh, I don't
because
think
we've got precedent. They did, you know, and you're right about what the ultimate effect of it is. Did Rutgers fans flood New York City? Did Maryland fans turn the year where it was held DC into just a sea of turtle red? No. and by the way, particularly with Maryland, that's a much more rabid. I'm telling you, and I've touched on this before in the past, having done a little time on the West Coast, the fan bases of these four schools that are coming in, and you might be able to make a case that Washington and Oregon are a little better than the two Southern California schools, but I'm telling you, these are not fan bases that are like the ones you know from the traditional Big Ten. So you're absolutely right. You can hold this thing in Vegas. You can hold it in LA. You can hold it in Seattle. It isn't going to make a difference. They're not going to turn out in numbers to justify the move. And yet, that will happen. I would bet the house in the next
2 years.
Five years might be a little stretch, but we're definitely going to see one turn in, I would say, the next 6 or 7 years. And the only reason I'm even hedging out that far is logistics might be an issue. I don't know. But we're going to see it on the West Coast. We're just going to. They're going to give them that because they did it with D.C. They did it with New York.
Yeah.
So I'm with you. You want to put it. And I guess I don't lock in enough. I want to say I just have this impression that the ACC shifts theirs around occasionally. They used to be locked into Greensboro, if I remember correctly, forever and ever.
Yeah.
And I don't think they are anymore.
But I could be wrong. Yeah.
But you're right. A lot of these leagues I don't think anybody is shifting around the way the Big Ten has. I think that is unusual. And yeah, you're right. It's without it being in a consistent location, it has an impact. You know, the Big Ten can argue, well, Final Four is in a different city every year. Yeah, but that's the Final Four.
Yeah, like the Super Bowl. Yeah.
This is a different deal. So I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, and I will tell you that having read social media impressions, at least from the Michigan State fan base, it seems that pretty much everybody is in alignment with your impressions. I haven't seen anybody saying, oh, no, this is a great atmosphere, tons of people showing up, feels like a live arena. You know, nobody's saying that.
No.
They're saying the upper bowl is largely empty. It's just not the same vibe you get it, particularly in Indianapolis. But I've been to the United Center for a few of these. I think that's, you could argue that Indianapolis is better, and I don't disagree. But I think Chicago's fine too. I would be A-okay if you, from my perspective at least, if you wanted to bounce it back and forth between those two venues, I think that's acceptable. But yeah. You start getting out to these other things. But again, arguing from pure self-interest, if you're gonna do this thing in Minneapolis, you're gonna do it in Southern California or Las Vegas, you're gonna do it on the East Coast, Detroit ought to get a shot.
You know, if you're the Big Ten and you just run the risk of, you know, you have a couple dud, you make it difficult for people. They're just unlikely to.
Well, here's the thing, though. I'm gonna argue.
Come every year.
I'm going to argue that, at least in terms of the stuff that we're talking about, you do this, say, in Detroit, you are not going to have poor turnout. You're just not.
That's true.
Michigan State and, to you know, a little Michigan, extent, yeah. Michigan fans,
Ohio State,
will alone. Look at the way the NCAA tournament has tended to go when it's been in Detroit.
Yeah.
There haven't been problems with attendance, and you do have those even in NCAA tournament games. You will have those issues in certain locations. That's not an issue in Detroit. And while it may not be Indianapolis, it's not as bad as Minneapolis in terms of travel for most of the conference schools. Mm-hmm. It's more centrally located to more schools. So, you know, on that, I'm just arguing from a pure Michigan State point of interest. If we're gonna play it this way, Detroit ought to get a turn sometime in the next decade. But we'll see.
Yeah, I would say there were not massive amounts to go for fans for a game that could have been huge turnout. And I think this is a reflection, like I said before, of just other stuff going on in Minneapolis. You know, and it was
that's
a new game, I guess.
I think it's two things. I think it's that, but I also think that it's. You have to have. Let's look at why are Indianapolis and Chicago successful? Well, Indianapolis is successful because you have two rabid basketball fan bases
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. Chicago is successful because you've got more Big Ten school alums living in that city than any other city in America, I believe. I'm pretty sure that's accurate. So that ensures that there will always be a decent turnout in Chicago. You don't have those factors in Minneapolis. You don't have either one of those in play. So anyway.
Yeah. All right. Well, so let's talk about the, I think somewhat surprising, but
to me,
sensible decision to fire Juwan Howard by Ward Manuel at University of Michigan. So what are your thoughts on this and sort of where they go from here?
Yeah. So the story I've got, and I talked to somebody, a media figure who would have reason to know what went on through people that he knows, and I've seen this in some Michigan sources as well, that this was a decision that came from the top. The president, Santa Ono, went to the athletic director, Ward Manuel, and said, you need to fire him. And pretty consistently, and this is why I was not a believer that Michigan would ultimately do this year. Apparently, Ward Manuel's initial reaction was he didn't want to do it. And you can get that because he's the guy who hired Juwan Howard.
Yeah.
And then you look at the way that athletic department has operated, it was easy to believe that they weren't going to move. But apparently what happened was Ward Manuel was told, if you don't fire him, we're firing you. And
that makes the decision easier.
Yeah. And so he did that. We've talked about this before here. The message this sends is an interesting one, because if you're going to try and argue, and there was an article in The Athletic from Brendan Quinn and Katie Strang over the last couple of days, that the breaking news in that was that Michigan apparently hired an outside firm to come in and independently evaluate the program's culture. Now, I would say if you're at that point, you have your answer already. You just don't to admit it, right? But But here's the thing. If it's really about, well, the culture is just unacceptable, it's unacceptably bad. Well, you had evidence of that before this season ever started, but you had more evidence once the season started. We've gone through this, the stuff with the strength and conditioning coach, the Doug McDaniel stuff, the weird way that the transition between Howard and Martelli was handled, the back and forth of all of that. That was all there. So what you're led to conclude is, hey, maybe all that stuff would have been okay if Juwan was winning a little bit more. You know, I'm not sure that's a great message, but regardless, it's what happened. So they just completed the worst season in modern Michigan basketball history. First time they finished last since the 60s, and it's worse than that because that was a 10-team league, and now it's a 14-team league. So it's even worse. It was as big a train wreck as one could imagine. 8 wins overall. Not in the league, overall. 3 wins in the league in 20 tries. And almost entirely uncompetitive in the losses. It's not like they were snake bit. This is a bad, bad basketball team. Terrible culture, all of it. So on those levels, yeah, totally justified. I just didn't think they would actually do it. So now the question becomes, what about the coaching search? And we are starting to have the makings of a very interesting coaching carousel season, because you've now got several high-ish profile jobs. I would say the 3 biggest at the moment would be Louisville, Ohio State, and Michigan. Now, Michigan is the outlier there, in my opinion. Ohio State, according to reports out of Columbus that I read yesterday, we'll see if they end up being valid. Supposedly, they are down to Dusty May from Florida Atlantic, which makes sense. Midwest guy, a lot of success at Florida Atlantic last couple of years. Hot name. And Jake Diebler, which surprises me. That's I did not think that candidacy would be taken seriously, but the guy went, I think, 6-2.
I mean, they've looked good.
Narrowly lost to Illinois last night. He's done everything you could ask a guy in his position to do. I still, push comes to shove, I don't think he's going to get that job, but we'll see. Maybe there's more support than I think. If he doesn't get that job, then that means Dusty May is still out there. And you got to think, as we've talked about before here, that this is the year Dusty May makes a move, because he kind of has to.
Yeah.
That Louisville job would look like a fairly natural fit in some ways for him. Maybe not always, but he was a student manager under Bob Knight at Indiana. He's from Illinois. So Louisville, we don't think of Louisville as the Midwest,
Kentucky,
but it's close. It's close. Yeah. It's close. And I went and looked at this, and I was reminded, it's shocking to think, it's been several years since they've been in the NCAA tournament. I mean, the Chris Mack era had a decent year or two to start, but then that hit the garbage pretty quickly. And the last 2 years under Kenny Payne have been beyond belief bad. But let's not kid ourselves. That's one of the best jobs in the country. It's one of the best jobs in the country primarily because the school cares about basketball so deeply, and they have support both institutionally and maybe even more importantly in the alumni base that makes it a great job. So whoever gets that job, that's the best job objectively, in my opinion,
right
now, and probably will remain so. Unless something weird happens. So where does all that leave Michigan? Well, if you look at Michigan, I think a lot of people automatically go to the thought that this is a big-time job because Michigan is a big-time athletic department. But you got to focus on basketball. And there are 2 major problems at Michigan. There is NIL. There's been clearly a lack of sufficient NIL support. That was evidenced by Hunter Dickinson opting to transfer and go to Kansas. That doesn't, for Eddie, and he was explicit. It was about NIL. That doesn't happen at a big-time program. It just doesn't. You know, you try to imagine Michigan State actually losing a guy they really wanted because of money, and it's unfathomable. In the modern era, I mean, not before when it was illegal and Tom Izzo would be part of that, but in the modern era, there's no way. It happened in Michigan, so that's an issue. But the second thing I think most people that I read have it backward. They think the NIL thing is the biggest deal. I don't, because I could see a world where that might get quasi-sorted out, and at least that they start finding ways to be a little more competitive. but they've got an admissions problem. That school does not want to treat transfers the way you have to treat them to be uber competitive in this current environment. Now, that may change again when we get the next iteration of college athletics to come up, but we don't know yet when that's going to happen. Right now, it's the Wild West, and if you want to compete, you've got to be able to get these guys into your school, and Michigan has proven that is a problem, and I don't think that anybody they're going to hire is going to be such that the school's going to roll over and say, okay, we'll adjust these things for you. That's not the Michigan way. So those two things have a real impact on the potential pool of candidates. They just do. And so any high major guy that you're reading about, the Michigan fans, I could not believe. I looked at the Detroit Free Press yesterday. They had an article, their Michigan beat writer. They had five guys. Not one of them was a viable candidate for that job. Five. No, they didn't get that crazy. But crazy enough, when the first name is Nate Oates, Nate Oates. You're not getting Nate Oates. First of all, they just announced a huge extension yesterday afternoon. But even before that, you're not getting Nate Oates. Why would Nate Oates take that job? It's a worse job for him. In all the ways that matter, it's a worse job. So we've said this before. The only major guy, he's looking to get out front of the posse, or he just has maybe there's been a change in the presidency or the AD spot, and they don't get along and they feel friction with a new situation. That's the only way. And I'm not seeing examples of that that would make sense. So I think, if I had to handicap it, I think it's going to be a mid-major plus kind of guy. And, you know, the problem with that from an MSU perspective is they could luck into a guy who can actually get the job done, at least better than it was under Juwan Howard. You know, I will admit, I worry about them bringing on a guy like DeVries, who I think from Drake, who you know well, who I think would be a viable candidate for that job, because a guy like him can look at Michigan, even with the limitations, and say, this isn't ideal, but I can work with this. I'm in the big time now. And look, you'd have to say that he would have a shot. I don't think he's a slam dunk, but he'd have a shot at making them competitive. You know, and there are other names. There's a handful of names. Nico Medved at Colorado State. He's a guy from Minnesota, Midwest guy. I could see that move. The Indiana State head coach. I could see that move. But there are some of these guys out there, and I think, push comes to shove, that's the pool they're going to be fishing from. It's not, hey, Tony Bennett wants to leave Virginia. I'd just be very surprised by that.
Yeah, no. Chris Collins or something.
Well, you know, his name has come up, and I guess I would say that's the one I wouldn't 100% write off. I'm going to be interested to see what kind of noise comes out of that whenever Northwestern goes out of the tournament, because that's when it'll start to heat up. Because we've talked about it, right? That it feels like if Chris Collins, that this is an inflection point. Like, either he decides I'm probably a lifer here, or this is my chance to get out. I'm losing all these guards. I'm probably not going to be as good next year. And, you know, that maybe this is the opportune time for him to jump. I guess I wouldn't completely rule that one out, but it's just something in my gut tells me he probably doesn't look to make that move. But you probably can't say that's the one high major coach name I've seen that I guess I wouldn't completely flush.
Well, and I would be less surprised, I suppose, if there's someone who makes a Sweet 16 run unexpectedly from one of these high major or mid majors or something like that, and then that's who they go after. Suddenly they'll be because it just takes a couple games, and suddenly you're the hot coaching candidate just for that season, and so it's your opportunity to get out, and so whomever that might be.
That could be one other name I would mention that I guess at least for the moment would qualify as a high major, it won't in a couple weeks, is Washington State's coach, Kyle Smith. He's a name I would watch. And the reason I say that is he's been in some situations. He was a coach at Columbia, and then he took the University of San Francisco job, and he did good jobs at those places. He's done a great job at Washington State, even though they blew the Pac-12 semifinal last night to Colorado. He's a guy, he's been mentioned with the opening at Stanford already, and I guess I wouldn't be surprised to see him end up in the mix at Michigan. So I guess you could consider him another a high major move, but that one's, you know, it depends on what the timeline is, how you evaluate that job. I would also say this. There's been some speculation that, John Beilein would be interested in coming back if they ask him. I can't fathom that for 100 reasons, but I wouldn't be surprised if John Beilein is someone they lean on in the search process.
Yeah, right.
And if they do that, then that's where guys like Kyle Smith start to become, you know, I think if there was a process that John Beilein was carrying some weight in, I think you're definitely going to see a particular kind of cast of characters involved. And it won't be any jazzy names, even if they could get those kind of guys, which I don't think they can. It won't be those kind of names. It'll be guys like Josh Smith or DeVries. It'll be guys that have built something. They've got kind of a culture, a way of playing, and they're not, they don't seem to be dependent upon the money stuff or the flashy, you know, we're going out landing, you know, three big name transfers kind of approach to building a program. So it'll be interesting to watch.
It'll certainly be dependent on what John Beilein's relationship is with Ward Manuel at Michigan.
And you're right about that. That's the one caveat, because I've seen people talk about Beilein's involvement as if it's kind of an assumed deal. But I've also seen it suggested that there's still a little friction there because of the way Beilein left,
mm-hmm.
which yeah. would make sense, at least on yeah. the surface.
For so, sure. All right. Well, I think we've gone pretty long. We're going to get out of here. I'm going to go to cup. We've gotten through 10 games. We only have three more to go as a family. Yesterday, actually, as an aside, we got my cousin, as I mentioned before, is an intern over at the Twins. So we got a personalized tour of the entire, was it Target Stadium? I can't think of what the name of it is right now.
Target Field.
Thank you. Yeah. So I was in the dugout and the locker rooms down in on the field. It was super cool.
You know, I have not been to a game there on
it's a beautiful
television.
Stadium.
It looks really nice.
It looks, you know, we were walking and it looked a lot like Comerica Field, but it's just like a little bit newer version. But it has a very, very much similar vibe to it. And
kind of open in the outfield. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And God, anything was going to be an improvement over the goddamn Metrodome.
But the Metrodome was bad. Yeah,
they really did it right. That's how it's always looked to me. That's great.
And the field is in beautiful condition because, you know, it's been a very mild winter. And so they're like, you know, weeks ahead of schedule. So anyway, so we'll get out of here and we'll be back with the selection show recap. So until next time, the Final Four is on the schedule.